And I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Dr. Alex Filipenko. He's professor of astronomy at the University of California at Berkeley, and he was a member of both teams that discovered the accelerating expansion of the universe, work that earned the Nobel Prize in Physics for the leaders of both teams. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for your interest.
So it turns out that only about 4% of the universe is made up of atoms and molecules, and basically the matter that makes up all the stuff that matters to us. What's the rest?
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. You know, we used to think that the universe is mostly just atoms and stuff, but we now know that actually the dominant stuff of the universe as a whole is this weird repulsive stuff called dark energy. Now, I don't mean repulsive in the sense that it's repugnant or something, but over the largest distances, it's making the universe, making space itself, expand faster and faster with time. And we know that it's there, but we don't know what it is, and yet it's basically 73% of the universe. It's mysterious, it's dark, unknown, so we call it dark energy. Now, another 23% is what we call dark matter. It's pretty mysterious as well. We know it's there, and it helps keep galaxies like our own Milky Way galaxy gravitationally bound. Galaxies would fly apart if it were not for the presence of this dark matter. But again, we don't exactly know what it is. So when you add all this together, you find that 96% of the universe consists of sort of bizarre, mysterious stuff whose presence we've indirectly detected, but which we have never detected directly, and we don't know exactly what it is. And so that's kind of disconcerting.
Is the word dark matter, dark energy, are those things metaphorical, or do they describe the properties of light or non-light that you see coming from this stuff?
Yes, both. They're dark in the sense that they don't emit any light, okay? Dark matter appears to not interact with light at all, and dark energy doesn't either. But they're also dark metaphorically, as you said, in the sense that we don't know what they are in any detail. We only know of their presence. So dark is used both ways.
So in our little 4%, which makes up everything that certainly our Earth and solar system and galaxy and all the other galaxies that we know are made of, and there's at least a possibility of some kind of life on other distant and unknown planets, just because sooner or later there's probably conditions similar enough to ours to support life. What about in this 96% of the universe? Are there conditions that would make it possible in any way for life to exist?
Probably not in the form of this dark matter or dark energy. In other words, the dark matter is probably some sort of weird little subatomic particles left over from the Big Bang. And the dark energy may just be a property of space itself, a sort of a uniformly distributed energy that doesn't coalesce into any sort of complex objects like molecules or you know, amoebas or people. But the dark matter and energy exist everywhere, and so they are present where life is present elsewhere in the universe, but they themselves don't help constitute life.
So what are the features of our universe and the kind of matter that we have around us in this 4% that allows complexity and therefore life to develop?
Right. Well, normal matter is made out of atoms, and atoms are made out of protons and neutrons in their nuclei and electrons that sort of orbit them, that sort of surround the nuclei. And these atoms then have the ability to stick together in molecules, okay? And even though the molecules themselves are electrically neutral, they have the ability to stick to other molecules because parts of molecules are more positive and parts are more negative, even though the whole thing is neutral. And so this slight charge separation allows molecules to stick together. And so ultimately, you know, we humans are bound together by electromagnetic forces, by essentially electrical forces between molecules. And this allows complexity to develop, and, you know, we have this rich periodic table that consists of 92 stable, naturally occurring elements. And all this allows complexity to develop because there are just so many different kinds of molecules that can form in so many different ways. when you're talking about dark matter and dark energy, you're talking, as far as we can tell, about things that don't clump together to form complex structures. The dark energy, we think, is really very uniformly spread throughout the universe. In fact, we think it may be just a property of space itself that, left to its own devices, tends to expand faster and faster with time. And the dark matter consists, we think, of just fundamental little particles left over from the Big Bang that do not have the ability to clump together through electric forces the way atoms and molecules are able to do so. So the dark matter only clumps together gravitationally, and it helps keep galaxies bound together. You know, they'd go flying apart if it weren't for this extra gravity provided by the dark matter. But the dark matter itself doesn't have the ability to form complex molecules or proteins or DNA or any of that kind of stuff that we think is necessary for life as we know it.
In one of your lectures, you quote the poem by Robert Frost, Fire and Ice. Some say the world will end in fire, some say ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I love this poem. I've memorized
it. Yes, I will quote it in my talk later tonight as well.
Oh, okay. Well, so fire and ice are the two alternative endings of the universe. Is that true? Do they describe the actual possibilities of how our universe will end?
Yes, this is what Frost was referring to. See, here's the idea. And back in the time that he wrote the poem, we didn't know about the dark energy and stuff. We knew only about the gravity that galaxies and stars exert on one another. And so when you have just normal attractive gravity, there are two possibilities. If, for example, you throw an apple up, all right, the attractive gravitational force of the Earth slows the apple down in its upward journey. Eventually it stops, and then the apple comes back down to your hand, okay? So applied to the universe, we have all the galaxies pulling on each other, and they should be slowing down the expansion of the universe. And one possibility is that the universe will someday stop expanding and then will recollapse. And when it recollapses, it becomes denser and hotter. You know, when you compress gases, they become hotter, sort of like when you pump air into a bicycle tire. The bicycle tire heats up because you're pumping the air in, you're doing work on it. So a collapsing universe becomes very dense, very hot, and ends in what we call a big crunch. And because it's really hot, Frost likened that to an ending in fire. Okay, so that's his ending in fire, a universe that recollapses. But now imagine you take this apple and you throw it at a speed greater than the escape speed from Earth, okay? Rockets do this, right? You launch them and they don't come tumbling back down to Earth. They keep on going away from Earth. So in that case, gravity of the Earth is still pulling on the apple or the rocket, but the apple or a rocket are moving so fast that they never get slowed down to a stop, and they never come back down to the surface of the Earth, right? The apple can keep on going away from the Earth forever. So in a similar way, if there's not enough stuff in the universe to slow the expansion down to a halt and cause the recollapse, then the expansion will continue forever, always more and more slowly with time, but never quite coming to a stop and never experiencing the big crunch. So that would be a fate that is basically described by eternal expansion. The universe becomes larger and larger with time, more and more dilute, less and less dense, darker and colder, okay? And so that would be an ending in ice, because the universe would become progressively colder with time, and Frost likened that to ice. So eternal expansion would be an ending in ice. And those were the two possibilities that physicists and astronomers had considered for many, many years.
We are wired as biological creatures with a life cycle that has a beginning and end. We understand things in terms of beginnings and ends and boundaries. And we talk about the beginning of the universe 13.7 billion years ago and its rapid expansion from basically nothing, or almost nothing, to this ongoing expansion and accelerating expansion now, and yet it's supposed to be infinite. And I'm still having trouble wrapping my mind around the idea that something that's already infinite can be getting bigger. if there's no boundaries.
Yeah, you know, so these are definitely pretty abstract concepts that are tough to wrap one's mind around. Regarding the universe and infinity, well, first of all, it might not be infinite, right? It might have started as a little tiny blob of material and expanded very rapidly during the Big Bang, and it's still expanding now, and indeed we think that it's expanding more rapidly now because of this dark energy, but it's still technically, you know, finite. In other words, if you were to take a slice of it at a constant time, it might be like a gigantic beach bubble. So it might be finite, in which case the expansion is a little bit easier to understand, right, to comprehend. But even if it's infinite, the expansion can be understood in the following way. Think about, for example, the counting numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. You know, those are infinite, right? Now consider just every 10. So 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, and so on. That's an infinite sequence as well, right? But in a sense, it's less dense, right? And then I can think about 100, 200, 300, and so on. And that's just as big an infinity, it turns out, as 10, 20, 30, or 1, 2, 3. But it, too, is less dense. So you can think of the counting number line or the real number line getting bigger and bigger, even though it's infinite in extent. Do you see what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. But, I mean, those things are still, I mean, we always think of these things in terms of a perspective which is so terrestrial.
Right, that's right. And so this is where, you know, our human minds over the course of a couple hundred thousand years of evolution, you know, the hunters and gatherers didn't need to think about infinity in order to get their next meal or to or to fight off an attacking lion or something like that, right? So our brains are not naturally hardwired to have a good grasp of infinity or expansion or things like that. And so now in the 20th and 21st centuries, physicists and astronomers and mathematicians have been considering these abstract ideas, and it's hard, you know, it's not easy for any of us. And we think mostly in terms of mathematics and the physical equations, but it's definitely difficult even for those of us working in these fields to have an intuitive feel for what's actually going on, because humans are not hardwired to do this kind of stuff.
We're talking to Dr. Alex Filipenko. He's a professor of astronomy at the University of California at Berkeley. Now, in that poem, Fire and Ice, by Robert Frost, fire and ice are metaphors for human emotion. Cosmology is suggestive of all kinds of metaphors, and I wondered, is the universe poetic for you, or do you see it more in mechanistic scientific terms?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, the scientist in me just sees it as a mechanical universe operating through physical laws that we have been successful in determining over the course of hundreds of years of science, and those of us alive right now and practicing science right now are trying to extend our understanding of those laws. So that's a purely mechanical universe. On the other hand, you know, each of us is human and has thoughts and feelings and emotions. And then to all of us, I think, some to a greater extent, some to a lesser extent, the universe is poetic. And to me, this is perhaps most keenly illustrated by the realization that, you know, humans, of all animals, have this unique ability to comprehend the universe and to ask questions and to come up with ways to try to answer the questions and try to understand how it is that all this came to be. And so in a sense, we are the way in which the universe has come to know itself. You know, no rocks or inanimate objects are able to do this, and even no other animals that we know of have this innate curiosity and ability to ask questions, and then the mechanical ability to build machines and try to answer those questions. And so we are a very special form of life, and it's amazing to me that this form of life even developed in the universe. There's no physical reason it had to have been this way. So I think of humans as the universe's way of coming to know itself, and to me that's a very poetic kind of image.
It is indeed, and I often wonder whether things like mathematics and cosmology are elegant works of art, so to speak, and meaningful to us specifically as human beings, versus whether they are objective perceptions of things that exist regardless of our naming them and shaping them.
Right. Yeah, this is an old philosophical question, actually, relating to mathematics specifically. One can ask, is mathematics invented or is it discovered? In other words, is it just sort of, in a sense, a human construct that we've developed to try to come to an understanding of all that is around us? Or is it fundamentally there and we discover it? I think it's the latter. I think that the universe is described by mathematics, and there are many ways in which one can develop mathematics. A simple example is base 10. Base 10 is based on our 10 fingers, our 10 digits, which helped in the early days of counting and all that. And base 10 also has other useful properties, like, you know, when multiplying by 10, you just add a zero to a number. So it has many useful properties, but we could just as well have developed in say, base 2. And in fact, computers are based on base 2, right? They're
right.
Zeros and ones, okay? There are many ways of describing mathematics, but fundamentally, I think the mathematics is there, and we discover it in one form or another. But I think the physical laws are based on mathematics, and to me, that's a very beautiful and intriguing and mysterious thing. Why should there be any mathematics? Why should there be any self-consistent physical laws? Ultimately, why should there be any universe at all? And that's a question I think science cannot answer, because we don't know of any way to experimentally or observationally test any of our hypotheses. So any hypothesis that's not testable is not, strictly speaking, a scientific hypothesis.
Right. Now, looking back at scientific discoveries over periods of centuries, we see that a significant percentage of things that we thought we knew, say, even 100 years ago, turned out to be incorrect, and we can reasonably expect that a pretty significant percentage of what science has figured out today will also be replaced 50, 100, 200 years from now. Do you ever think about what are the things in your field that are most likely and least likely to withstand the test of time?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting point. It's true that much of what we know now is different from what we knew in the past, but a lot of it is in the form of refinements of existing theories. So let me give you an example. Newtonian gravity works quite well, okay? I mean, it describes the motion of baseballs and airplanes and things like that very well. But when objects move at high speeds, we need to use a more complete theory called Einstein's special theory of relativity that deals with large speeds. Or when we have large masses, we have to use Einstein's general theory of relativity. So relativity is a more complete theory of gravity and motion than Newtonian physics. But in the limit that we're dealing with small speeds or small masses, Newtonian physics works fine. So, is relativity complete? We know that it's not. We know that when we go to very small objects, we have to use quantum physics. Quantum physics is a better theory of what's going on when we go to small scales. And it works well for atoms and molecules, but if we were to have a large amount of mass in a small distance, in a small volume, we would have to use both quantum physics and general relativity, and we know that at this time they are mutually incompatible. We don't yet have a quantum theory of gravity, and that's what the so-called string theorists are working on. They're working on an even more complete theory of gravity and quantum physics. And so if and when they develop it, it won't mean that, you know, the quantum theory that we used to use was wrong. You know, it worked well for developing semiconductors and all this great technology that we now have at our disposal. It'll just mean that we have a more complete understanding of all of physics. That's the way in which a lot of physics has changed, okay? Now, it's also true, however, that there were things we thought we used to know, and they turned out to be completely wrong. So an example is Ptolemy's method for predicting the positions of planets. You know, it was based on a system where Earth was at the center, and the planets orbited Earth, and he added these little epicycles on top of their orbits, and it was all very complicated, but he could predict with almost arbitrary accuracy the observed positions of the planets in the sky. So it was a very successful model. But we now know that it was completely wrong, right? The planets orbit the sun, not the Earth. So in a similar way, it could be that today's dark matter and dark energy are just modern-day versions of the Ptolemaic model, right? Where, you know, we've got all these gizmos, all these epicycles, in a sense, trying to describe what we see, trying to come to an understanding of what we see. But it could be that this description that we've come up with is simply wrong. And I sometimes wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning worrying that our description of what we think we see in terms of dark energy and dark matter will turn out to be completely wrong.
So it's a humbling field to be in.
Yeah, that's right. What we've measured are two things. First of all, galaxies are gravitationally bound together. Okay, the stars are bound together in these structures we call galaxies. And yet, without dark matter, we don't understand how galaxies could remain gravitationally bound, okay? So we think of this stuff called dark matter. But maybe, you know, Newton's version of gravity and maybe Einstein's version of gravity are simply wrong. And gravity acts in a different way over the distances of stars, you know, in a galaxy, and maybe they're bound together for some other reason, okay? And secondly, we see an accelerating expansion of the universe. And that puzzles us because gravity is normally thought to be attractive. And so we hypothesize dark energy to be the explanation for this observed accelerating expansion of the universe. But maybe that's completely wrong. Again, maybe gravity acts in a different way over very large distances in such a way that, you know, the universe expands more and more quickly with time. And indeed, some physicists are considering possible modifications to general relativity to explain this observed phenomenon for which the Nobel Prize was awarded last year. And that observed phenomenon is the accelerating expansion of the universe. So what we've observed is the acceleration, and what other astronomers have observed is the fact that galaxies are bound together. Those observations seem to be on very solid ground, okay? The interpretation in terms of dark matter and dark energy is on less solid ground, I think, is more subject to possible modification in the future than the observed facts. I call them facts because I think that they're quite well substantiated. The observed facts that galaxies are bound and that the universe's expansion is accelerating with time.
Dr. Alex Filipenko is professor of astronomy at the University of California at Berkeley. Thank you so much for joining us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much.